Good evening. Thank you, Brant, for those songs. The telling the story, the old story, is the story of stories, of course, where all stories should point toward. We're glad to see you here tonight. We did plan to take a love offering for our brother, so if the ushers would be ready for that, maybe we would do that first. If you want to come forward, we'll have a prayer and then take the offering. Let's bow our heads. Thank you, Lord. Perhaps as we take the offering, I'll make a few comments from Hebrews, where he talks about chastening, and we heard about suffering. We've heard about, I talked to a visitor this morning that was here, and she faces a lot of opposition for the cause of Christ. Her father says, you're following an antiquated old book, and she had tears in her eyes. She's told her father finally that if it's a choice between you or following Jesus, and I hope it never comes to this, but I'm going to follow Jesus. And I was blessed. Something that probably most of us here, now some of you that have left the Old Order Church have faced that in being shunned, and we heard about that last night. So there are those things that we suffer for the cause of Christ. I told her that's suffering for the cause of Christ. Sometimes we suffer for various things, and it's just maybe an illness, and we don't know really if it's a chastening. Here in Hebrews it talks about a chastening from the Lord. And it says, if you are a son of Christ, then you will be chastened of the Lord. That's a sign that you are of the Lord. However that chastening looks, and we don't stand up here and judge, okay, you're being chastened, you're having a tough time here. But maybe we are. And we should always just remember that God is faithful. If we are his son and that we are his daughter, there will be those times that God will bring about affliction in our lives to keep us true and faithful to him, like we do for our own natural children as fathers. And we're imperfect, but God is perfect, and he does things well. I'm grateful for that. After that discussion here in Hebrews, he says, wherefore, and I think it's significant, I noticed the fact that after he talked about some tough times in life, he says to us, to the rest of the church, he says, wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down, and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, and let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men, and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God. And then he talks about a root of bitterness coming in. I'm grateful this evening that we have a brotherhood. And I'm grateful that we can come together and we can lift up the feeble hands and the weak knees. That's what the church is for. In these times of chastening, perhaps, or trouble, and we live in an imperfect world. This world has been affected by sin. And so things will not be perfect. Things will not be sometimes as we've planned. But God is gracious to us, and he's given us the church. And so I'm grateful for that. We'll have our brother come up now. Thank you for the offering. We'll pray again before he begins speaking. Thank you, God, for blessing our time together again this evening. Thank you for everyone that's here. We pray a special blessing on Leroy as he tells us bits and pieces of that old story in in other forms perhaps, but in ways that will bring us and draw us to the Master Storyteller. We ask that you would, that the Holy Spirit would be present as he presents this in his heart. Fill him even now. We pray for all of us that we would have your Spirit in us and we could receive what you have for us tonight. Just bless the service for your honor and glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Bless you, brother. Amen.
Thank you for those words, John. And you're sticking with me. Thank you for coming by yet once again. I want to talk for a minute or two about the similarity between storytelling and painting. I heard the song leader say something about that. He used the term painting. And in that there are ways in which there is a similarity. And if you can back there, Arlen, see if you can get that picture on. If it shows up, we'll talk about it for a minute. And I want to just take a moment to thank Bubba and Arlen and Kyle for making me sound good. You can't tell stories if nobody hears you. And I've done sound, so I know that when you're doing a good job, nobody notices. So thank you for that. I will just mention that, we think, we maybe sometimes aren't sure what the big difference is in worldviews. Ah, there it's coming. Yeah, this is a, it's not a very sharp picture. It's what I got, but we'll talk about it just a little bit. It's the Return of the Prodigal. And this is a painting, a picture of a picture of a picture of a beautiful painting that hangs in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg in Russia. And the original, it would fit right in here, kind of the size of that arch there. It's that big, and it's painted very vividly and beautifully. And it illustrates not one moment, not a particular moment in the Luke 15 story. It is storytelling in that it picks out a number of important things, ideas in that story, and combines them there. So if you read, Luke 15 is Jesus in response to the Pharisees, and they're standing there like, you kind of see a Pharisee kind of posture over there, and they're saying, he thinks he's a rabbi and he's eating with publicans and sinners. How disgusting. I mean, that's basic. Keep yourself pure. You know, that's going through their minds. And Jesus just gets up and he says three stories. He says the story of the lost sheep. There were nine, and there's one missing, and what happened? The story of the lost coin. The woman sweeps her house to find that precious lost coin. And then the story of the lost son. And I submit to you that this story is the most succinct, the most summarized, perfect single story to illustrate why Jesus came and what the work of redemption is. So if we look at what Rembrandt did there, he was an old man. He died soon after he painted this painting. He had been wildly successful in his youth. He had money, he had a beautiful wife that he loved, he had children. It was just great guns going forward for him. And then horrible things happened. His wife, his lovely, beautiful, beloved wife died. His beloved son died when he was 22. He'd just gotten married. All of his children died before he did, and he suffered. And he often, he painted a version of this when he was a young man, and it's the father running out and the son coming, and they're strong and they embrace each other. This is sort of depicting the point of view that Rembrandt had in his old age. And you see that father there, and if you look, it's hard to see, I'm sorry about that, but he looks almost blind. His eyes aren't seeing much. But what we've got there is the prodigal returning. And what you see is those wonderful arms around him there. He's spread and covered, and he's drawing him in. I think that the prodigal's head there is shaped kind of like a newborn's. And it's, I think he did that intentionally. He's pointing out that there is rebirth going on here. And the light, especially in the original, is just magnificent and beautiful. It almost feels like it emanates out of that father's face. He can't see physically anymore, but he has spiritual vision, and it bathes his hands, and it bathes the returning prodigal there. And I like to notice his shoes. I'm really into shoes. Look at that guy's shoes there. The one is all tattered and off and looking pretty rough. And he's wearing kind of like the last bits of underwear almost. And the only little suggestion that he came from an important royal family, you can almost not see it, but he has a little tiny, like a dagger on his belt there. And you know, if you were just totally a pauper, you wouldn't have that. That's like the last little bit to suggest that he belongs to this family. And then over here on the side, we think that's the older brother. But you know, thinking about Pharisees and his attitude, he knew the law. He knows the law. He's been a good son. And he's standing there. The light from the Father bathes his face a little bit, but his posture is not one of receiving grace. He's looking down there and he's thinking, you rascal, half of the inheritance. You need to, you know, where's the retribution? Where is the justice here? He's looking on. I'm reading a little bit in there, honestly, forgive me. But he's looking on too, and he's seeing an amazing thing happen there, and he's at the edge of that. And in the story, we don't know what his response will be. It's left open-ended, like any good story. You're invited into it. In this story, there have been times when I felt like the prodigal when I look at that. But there's been more times when I've caught myself being the older brother. And I'm looking at redemption, at Christ's redemption, and I am offended. This is not fair. You have squandered, you have hurt, and you're forgiven. It's not fair. I feel that. And I suppose if we're honest, many of us have been at a moment like that. We don't really know what those other two figures are. Somebody thinks maybe the little dark one in the back is his mother. It could have been a servant. The other one sitting there with a beautiful velvet hat, that looks like Rembrandt a little bit. He always put himself into scenes, you know, one of the characters. We're not sure what that is. He's looking on too there. And we can sort of, in a good story, in a good painting like this, this illustrates a really important truth out of the Bible. It could illustrate anything. We're invited into that, and we're invited to see ourselves in that picture or in a good story. And we identify with the characters in it because the characters are out of real life. And we are alive, and so of course we feel that. So I submit to you that we do experience the different people there, but what God is calling us to in being part of Christ's church is to become that Father who waits and offers forgiveness and puts his hands out and heals broken people and finds the lost and brings them into redemption and into the love of Christ and into his church. So I hope that is illustrative a little bit and that it helps you see what storytelling can do, what painting can do. There's beauty along with truth. And we can just blurt out truth. Sometimes it's called for, that's appropriate. And other times we clothe the truth in paint or in a story, and it makes it more accessible. We let our guard down, we don't feel like we're being preached at, and we get sucked into it, and we identify, and it reaches not just our head, but our heart somehow. That's what we're after here. And that's where power and story and painting and in beauty touches our lives and brings us forward into a wonderful new place. So thanks for that. We can switch that off now. I go to national storytelling festivals. I have for many years. Don't go every year now because, you know, you go over and over again and you get to know most of the players and pick up a lot of stories and techniques. And a wonderful little storyteller from Los Angeles showed up about 10 years ago, and his stage name was Izzy Tuwinski. And he juggled. And everybody liked it, and it kind of calmed him down and us. And then he proceeded to tell a story. And he inspired me to go home and learn to juggle. And he told a story that's been told for about 150 years, and it comes out of Poland, out of the rabbinical tradition there. Jewish rabbis told this first. A Jewish rabbi told it. And it goes like this. There's variations. In a far-off country, on top of a hill, in an old castle, down in the kitchen, over by the sink, under the table, sat a young boy who would one day become king. But all was not right with the young boy because he thought he was a turkey. People say that on a particular day, the king put on a huge feast and invited lords, ladies, important people from all the land to his huge banquet table, and they ate and they drank. And when they were finished, the king got up and he made a wonderful speech. And it had power and glory in it. And when he was done, the queen got up and she told a story. And the story had beauty and grace in it. And then people say the young prince was pushed up on the table and expected to tell a story or say a speech. And he was 13 years old. And he looked at all those people looking at him, those eyes, and he got dry mouth and he started sweating and shaking. And all of a sudden he turned around, he jumped off that table, and he ran out of the banquet hall, down the hall, and as he ran, he threw off his velvet cape. He tore his silk shirt to pieces, kicked off his red socks, and ripped off his breeches. And ended up in the kitchen, under the table, gobbling like a turkey. Now, he did not want to be a turkey. He had no plans on being a turkey. But when he thought about all of the responsibility that came with ruling the kingdom, he knew there was no way he could do that. And the good thing about being a turkey is you did not have to rule. So he stayed right there, and he wouldn't talk, and he wouldn't eat anything except grain that the cooks would throw down on the floor for him to peck at. Now, naturally, his father and mother were really concerned, and they tried to talk to him, but he wouldn't listen. They got in healers and sages, monks and nurses, and they gave him foul-smelling potions and rubbed-on green lotions and did incantations, and nothing helped. The young prince would not respond. The family was in despair. One day, an unusual man came walking up that hill and asked to see the king. He had on a shabby coat and a really strange hat, but his face shone like a new star. And he asked the king and the queen, "Could I have a go at curing the turkey prince?" And they said, "Why not? It won't hurt to try." Well, the strange man walked down the hall and he stood in a corner in the kitchen and he watched the strange activity of the turkey prince for 2 days. And on the third day, to everyone's surprise, he moved over there, tore off his cloak, ripped off his shirt, all his clothes, and he went down in there and he squatted under the table right next to the turkey prince. And for the first time in weeks, the turkey prince talked. He looked at the healer and he said, "Just who do you think you are, and what right do you have to be here with me?" Well, the healer spoke slowly and he said, "I'm surprised you can't tell. I'm a turkey just like you." Well, the turkey prince decided, well, yeah, he is a turkey just like me. And he was lonely. He was pleased with that. And so they sat under the table there and they chatted and enjoyed each other's company. And they both pecked at the grain that the cooks threw down for them. Well, late that night, the fires in the wood cook stoves died down, and it got cold in there. And the healer said, "Watch this." And he got out from under the table, and he went over, and he grabbed a big cloak off the rack by the door, wrapped himself in it, came back, and squatted there under the table. And the turkey prince looked at him and said, "What is this? You're a turkey, but you're wearing the cloak of a human being." Well, the healer said slowly, "I know what I'm doing. I'm a turkey who is cold. Why shouldn't I wear a cloak if I'm cold?" And the young prince thought, well, that makes sense. And he clumsily got out from under the table, went over, helped himself to a cloak, wrapped himself in it, and was much more comfortable. So they spent the night warm for a change. Well, the next night, the healer said, "Watch this." And he got out from under the table. He said, he went over to the kitchen counter, and there was a half a loaf of brown bread there. And he sawed off a nice fat piece, and there was yellow cheese over in the icebox. And he got that out, slabbed off a big piece, put it on there, and took a bite. "What?" squawked the young prince. "You're eating people food, and you're a turkey." Well, the healer said, "I'm a turkey who's hungry for bread and cheese. Why shouldn't I eat it?" Well, the young prince thought, that makes sense. He was hungry for bread and cheese too. He got out, slabbed off some bread, put cheese on it, ate it. Bit by bit, the young prince learned to trust that healer and followed him out from under that table. And he started acting a little more like a normal child would. And he followed the healer out of the castle, and they walked through the villages. And he got to see people who were young and playing, people in school. He saw old people lying on their deathbeds, and he learned what it was like to be a human being. Well, the healer decided, we're going on a trip. And they took off with some provisions, and they went over tall mountains off to distant countries. And the young prince learned how to find water in the desert. He figured out, with help from the healer, how to build bridges over rivers. And he was able to find the smile on a sad child's face sometimes. When they finally returned from that huge trip, the healer presented the young prince to his father and mother and said, "Your son loves his life again, and my work here is finished." Well, they gave him a brand new coat and a bag of gold and all of the love and appreciation that a family can give for a son who's been healed. The healer took off and went on his way. And the wheel of time turned, and eventually the king and the queen grew old and died. And the turkey prince became king in his father's stead. And he was a good king. And he spent a lot of time out among his people. He would visit villages. And one day he was at a village and he was giving a speech. And his speech was about redemption and about sacrifice. And as he spoke, he noticed a couple over here in the crowd, and they looked like they were troubled, like something terrible was going on. And after he was done, he went over to them and said, "Is there something I can do for you?" Well, the dad was like, "I don't think so. We have a horrible problem." And the mom said, "Well, you see, we have this young son, and he thinks he's a turkey, and we can't do anything with him." Well, the king said, "Take me to him at once." And so off they went, down the alley and around, and they came to the little house, and they opened the door, and the turkey king walked inside, and down the hall, over in the kitchen, right by the sink was a wooden table, and under the table sat a frightened little boy. To everyone's surprise and astonishment, the king set off his gold crown. He threw off his cape, and he rushed right down that hall, down into the kitchen, and he squatted under the table right next to that little boy. And the little boy looked at him and spoke for the first time in weeks. He said, "Just who are you? And what right do you have to be down here under the table with me?" The king told him slowly, he said, "I'm surprised you can't tell. I'm a turkey just like you." That's the turkey prince. And it's a lot like Izzy Tuwinski told it. But it comes in many different forms. It started out as a rooster, but I like the turkey version better. And I hope you liked it too. I've got a couple more little stories. But I'm going to stop and see, does anybody have questions? Or, you know, sometimes when you're telling stuff, you start something and you forget. And then people are like, "Well, when are you going to finish that?" And this is your last chance if you've got some kind of request or question or comment. Because I'm not coming back after. I'm leaving tomorrow morning on the airplane and going far away. So if somebody has something you'd like to ask me, please do now if you want. And it can be about technique or stories or just about anything you want to ask. Yes, over here. If you wait, they're coming with a mic so everybody can hear.
I'm just curious. I don't remember that you said, but maybe you did. But When did you start telling stories, and what really intrigued you about stories and drew you into being a good storyteller?
Okay, what got me started? My mom loved, she told stories. I've met friends who are very interested in Christianity and in the Amish Mennonite way of life. But, we talk very seriously about it, and they say, deep down in the middle of me, I feel like there has to be something that it's like just almost an instinct for believing that God exists or not. And they say, I don't have that. And I've thought about that a little bit, because I do have that. And I've thought about how that might be in there. How mysterious is that? Or could you think about it right? And I just know that my earliest memories include my mom reading Bible stories to me at bedtime. And it was that old book, and it had woodcuts in it, of Abraham sacrificing Isaac and, all these pictures. And I remember looking at those and hearing them. And I am of an opinion that those stories when I'm just coming out of unconscious to conscious memory really had a big role in playing in who I am and how I think about my worldview. So I think that's part of it. I was exposed to storytelling even before I can remember, and it organized and it made my worldview. I think that's part of it. But I learned to appreciate it simply because I went to church like most of you did most of my life. And, there's different kinds of preaching, and some of it is, lists and do's and don'ts and things. And often it includes stories. If you're reading the Gospels, you just can't help it. There are amazing, powerful stories in there. And they get your attention, and they got my imagination going. And I just liked them. And so when you hear somebody do that, create a story, you're like, how did they do that? And I get all interested, and I get my I want to go get the screwdrivers out and take them apart and see where the story is, How do you get the smoke and the sparks out? So I guess it's that kind of, I'm really interested in how things work and how they're organized and how you do stuff. So a combination maybe of being touched deeply by stories and also really wanting to know. The wonderful thing is you don't have to know terminology. You can simply take an interest in storytelling and practice on children and on your friends, and you can get good at it. And it's a wonderful thing to do. We are all storytellers. We're just at different stages of it. So I don't know, that's part of what you ask. Am I missing something? I got kind of sidetracked there. But good question. Thank you for that. Anyone else want to ask something or say something? That's fine. We'll have another chance tonight yet. So just raise your hand and we'll get you if we get that far. I have a little story. I don't even know where I heard it, but it's from the Cherokee tradition. And Cherokees, as some of you know, used to live in North Carolina and in Virginia, and they were pushed west. And so most of us think that they're from Oklahoma, but they were strangers and foreigners in Oklahoma, even though that's where many Cherokee live now. They have a story about first man and first woman that I want to tell you. It goes like this. They're kind of the Adam and Eve characters in their mythology. When first man and first woman first were created and they found each other, they were absolutely delighted. They were so pleased with each other, they just couldn't get enough. And they did everything together. And they loved each other, and it was just joyful. Well, after a while, as we know, new things, the newness wears off a little bit. And one day, first man got up on the wrong side of bed. And he was kind of grouchy. And first woman tried to appease him. It's like, what's the deal here? And he was just in shock, you know, and disagreeable and critical. And they had words. And finally it turned into an argument. And all of a sudden, first woman had enough. And she took off, and she went toward the setting sun. And Adam was just like, huh, you know, this is nice. It's quiet for a change. I'll just enjoy it. And so he sat there a while, and it wasn't long till he realized that this wasn't going to be fun after all. He was feeling lonely already. And he realized deep in his heart that he had to go catch first woman, and he was going to have to figure out how to get back together again and make peace. So he took off towards the setting sun, following her. But he was not doing well because, as we all know, angry women walk fast. And he was simply not catching up. He was losing ground. And the sun looked down and saw his predicament and felt sorry for him and tried to help. And the sun shone down on this ground up in front of first woman and made blackberries grow up, big, tall blackberries, and woof, they were full, hanging, you know, just ripe and tasty. First woman was still so mad, she just walked right around and kept right on going. Well, that didn't work. Sun tried again, shone down on the earth and caused raspberries to grow up, big red raspberries. First woman just marched right around there, didn't even notice. So sun tried a third time and shone down on the ground and caused a huge patch of strawberries to grow up, big red delicious strawberries. First woman didn't notice a thing. She just stomped right through the middle of that strawberry patch. But when she crushed those strawberries, the wonderful aroma of fresh strawberry came up into her nostrils. And she had to stop because it was so beautiful. And she looked down at her feet and she saw these bright red berries she'd never seen before. And she reached down without thinking and plucked one off and put it in her mouth. And it was so amazingly sweet and tart, she completely forgot her anger. And she kind of squatted down and she just kept eating and eating, and all of a sudden she realized she wanted first man to have some of these too. And she had a little apron and she sort of made a little basket out of her apron and she started picking strawberries into it to take back to first man. And as she was going, first man finally caught up. And there he was, and he wasn't sure what to do next. So he was quiet. He had some innate wisdom there. First woman realized he was nearby and stood up. And first man opened his mouth to say something. Before he could even say a word, she picked a strawberry out and put it in his mouth. And he bit down on it, and it was so tasty. He got shivers up and down his spine. And so they ate strawberries together, and they were reconciled. And they went home, and they lived well together after that. And when they had problems, they could always think back to that time, and it helped them solve their problems. And the outcome of that is, ever after, during the season of ripe strawberries, couples get along really well because they're eating strawberries, and how could you possibly quarrel while you're having that wonderful taste in your mouth? So that's a fun little story for you couples and you people who are thinking about becoming couples. Serve up strawberries. It will improve your marriage. I've had some wonderful strawberries since I came here, so I can attest to it that you know how to do that. I think we have time for one more fun little story before the end one here. And I think I told this at school. Are there school children here who are in first and second grade? May I say it again? Sure, right there. Shall I do the story again about Yasi? You don't mind? All right, I will. This is a story that I heard from Sid Lieberman, but again, it's an ancient story. It's probably, it could easily be 2,000 years old. And it gets slightly different clothes every generation, and this is the way I like it. I've read a number of different versions, and this is the one I really like, and it goes like this. Yasi was a shoemaker who lived in the little town of Studena. Studena was in Hungary, and it was some distance from Budapest, the capital. Every morning, he'd get out of his little house, and he'd walk down the path, and he would work in his little shop. He was a shoemaker. He repaired shoes. It wasn't like it is now. You know, if you had shoes and the soles came off, what would you do with them? What would you do? You'd get new ones. Where would you get them? Walmart, right? Yeah. See, they didn't have Walmart back in Studena. This was like 150 years ago. You really took care of your shoes, and if the soles ripped loose, you took them to Yasi, and he would carefully sew them back on. He could put new soles on if he needed to. He could nail a heel back on if it tore off. People regularly did that, so he had work just about every day. But he was also known for his wisdom, so people would come and they would ask him questions, hard questions, and he usually had a good answer. For instance, a little old lady came to him one day and said, "Yasi, I have a terrible problem. Please help me." And Yasi said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "The butcher's son wants to marry my daughter." "Oh," he said, and stroked his beard, "what's the problem with that?" "Well," she said, "you know, he's blind in one eye and he can't see out of the other one very good." Well, Yasi thought a little about that, and finally he said, "Well, you know, your daughter isn't that much to look at anyway. It'd be a good match." He was smart that way. Word got out, and people would stop in, even some like noblemen and women from all the way down in Budapest, just to hear him. They'd stop in and kind of be there, you know, in the shop listening, and they'd leave again. And that's how Samuel heard about Yasi. Now, Samuel was a merchant down in Budapest. And he was not just any old merchant. He was the most successful merchant in all the town. He had the biggest, nicest house. His women wore the nicest clothes, and he had the largest belly of any merchant in Budapest. And he was very pleased with himself. When he heard about Yasi, he thought, "Aha! For my daughter's wedding, I'm going to invite Yasi. I'll be the talk of the town." So he went right to his desk and he sat down and he wrote a letter to Yasi saying how much he appreciated wisdom and teaching and invited Yasi to come to his daughter's wedding and be the honored guest. Well, when Yasi got that letter, he opened it up. He almost never got letters. He was so pleased. He'd wanted to go to Budapest his entire life, and here he has a chance. He took it right home, closed his shop, took it home, read it to his wife. Said, "Look!" And his wife listened, and then she said, "Yasi, you don't have nice enough clothes to wear to one of those highfalutin weddings down in Budapest." Yasi said, "Nonsense. Just because a billy goat has a long beard does not make him a rabbi. I'll wear the best clothes I have. They'll be good enough for that wedding, and nobody will mind." "I don't know about that," said his wife, and she went on sweeping the little house. Yasi did not pay any attention to that, and when the day came, he got up early, and he had a bath, and he put his best clothes on, and he got ready for the stagecoach. And he got on, and they went bumping down the rough road to Budapest. And he didn't even mind because he was so excited. I mean, trip of a lifetime for him. When they got there, he got off and he was utterly amazed. It was more than he had imagined. The houses were 3 stories tall. And they were painted on the outside, and there were flower boxes in the windows with beautiful flowers. He was walking around looking at all the finely dressed people. I mean, they had amazing clothes on, and it wasn't even Sunday. He was walking, and he saw carved stone lions. There were beautiful bridges over the River Neva. And he was looking at stuff, just, wasn't seeing where he was going, and all of a sudden, he tripped and fell into a hole right there, plonk. And he got mud all over his nice white shirt, and he ripped the side of his shirt open. And he looked at himself and was like, oh my, what would my wife say if she saw me now? Oh well, he said to himself, I'll explain everything to Samuel and it'll be all right. And he went off towards Samuel's house. At Samuel's house, Samuel was standing at the front door, welcoming guests. How do you do? So good to see you. Step right on in and over to the left. And he looked out and he saw coming down his street what looked like a beggar, this kind of peasant man, and he had on torn clothes and mud all over them, and a dark look crossed his face. And when Yossi came right up to him, before he had a chance to open his mouth, Samuel put his hands on his shoulders and said, now look here. Today is my daughter's wedding, and not only that, I'm expecting the wisest man in all the land to come, and I do not want him to see a beggar on my front steps. Spun him around, shoved him out in the street, and said, begone. Oh, said Yossi to himself, so this is the man who says he loves wisdom. I think we need to teach him a lesson. And he hurried on out, and he knocked on the door of a nobleman who'd visited him the week before and said, stop in if you ever come to Budapest. Explained everything, and the nobleman said, come in. And he opened his wardrobe, and the wardrobe was full of beautiful clothes, and he said, help yourself. Yossi took off his torn, muddy clothes, and the first thing he selected were purple velvet pants. I mean, if you're going to dress up. And then he selected a white Italian shirt, the kind with the big ruffles that go all the way down the front here. And then it was a royal blue suit coat, and it had gold and silver brocade all around it, and the buttons looked like little silver acorns. Tall brown riding boots for his feet. And then the nobleman put his own stovepipe hat on, the really tall black ones, you know, gave him his mahogany walking stick, the kind with the gold ball on the top. Yossi couldn't help himself. He stopped by the mirror and he had a look and he was like, very nice. And he walked out the door and back to Samuel's house. This time, when Samuel saw him coming, he looked at those clothes and he said, ah, that must be the wise shoemaker. Look at those clothes. I knew he was a wise man. And he welcomed him in. And immediately the wedding took place. And as soon as it was over, everybody moved on over to the big reception hall for the feast. Yossi was seated right next to the bride and groom on the other side of Samuel in the seat of honor. The first thing they did at that wedding was everybody had a little glass of wine. Everybody stood up, picked up their glass of wine, and Samuel pronounced a toast or a blessing. He said, to your health and happiness and many good years. Everybody said, hear, hear, and they all drank their wine glass. Glug, glug. Everybody drank their wine, that is, except Yossi. He just stood there holding his little glass of wine. Everybody turned their attention to him. They, he's a wise shoemaker. He might tell a story. And they got really quiet. Yasi just smiled, didn't say a thing, pulled out those purple velvet pants, poured the wine right down his pants. Did you see that? Nobody said anything, though, because he was, after all, the wise shoemaker. They sat down, and the first course was chicken noodle soup. Yasi pushed his chair back, pulled off one of those brown riding boots, and dumped his soup in his boot, swished it around, and stuck his foot back in it. Slurp. Ew. The whole meal went like that. He put the chicken paprishka into his coat pocket. He had sauerkraut smeared up this sleeve. He had cooked carrot smeared down this one. When the peas came around, he took his top hat off and he forked peas in there and put it back on his head. Now, there were two little boys in that wedding, and they thought that was the smartest thing they'd ever seen. They appreciated the wise shoemaker, and they took their little black hats off, and they forked their peas in there and were putting them on when their mother saw them and said, "You are not the wise shoemaker. You eat your peas." That's what she said. Well, it was time for dessert, and they brought out the dessert, and it was a gorgeous, enormous Apfelstrudel. And everybody looked at that, and they immediately thought, oh no, what's he gonna do with that beautiful Apfelstrudel? And when it came to him, Yasi smiled, took his time, selected the biggest piece, and looked at it, everybody was watching, and he smashed it against the ruffles of that Italian shirt and smooshed it all the way down. Well, that was the last straw. And Samuel got up and he looked at Yasi and he said, "Yasi, I invited you here because you had the reputation of being a wise man, and we expected you to teach us something or to tell a story, and instead you've been acting like an absolute idiot." Yasi looked a little surprised and frightened. He got up and said, "But Samuel, I've been teaching you ever since I set foot in your house. You see, when I came in the clothes of a beggar, you turned me away. But when I came back in the clothes of a wealthy man and you invited me in warmly, I realized you did not care about my own self. All you cared about was my nice clothes. And I thought it would only be right for me to feed your fine food to the nice clothes, since that's what you really liked." And with that, he picked up his cup of tea and he poured it into his other coat pocket. And he patted it and he said, "Drink well, my coat." And he picked up that mahogany walking stick with the gold ball on it and he walked out the door. Well, the next morning, Yasi was back in Studena in his little house, and he was sitting at his table, and he was munching on a dry piece of toast. That was his breakfast. And he was thinking about all the amazing things that had happened to him the day before in Budapest. And as he was sitting there munching and meditating, his wife came in and she was sweeping and she swept all the way over until she was right in front of him there, and she stopped and she said, "So Yasi, was I right about the clothes?" Yasi didn't say anything. He was a wise husband. He just got up and he reached for the broom, and his wife gave him the broom and he held it out, did a little jig with the broom. And he held it over here and he said, "We could dress this broomstick up and it would be as well dressed as the best dressed person I saw yesterday in Budapest." And then he winked at his wife and he said, "You know, fools only see a person's clothes. The wise also see their souls." That's the wise shoemaker for you. Thank you for listening. I'm kind of into strawberries. This little story is from the Pacific Rim. Again, an old, old story from another culture that's been told for a long time. And it's in the Taoist tradition, and so it won't. You are required to do some work in this story, and you'll figure it out. It goes like this. There's a man, and he was out one morning early looking for his breakfast. And he's looking this way and that in the jungle, just looking for anything that he could eat. And he's walking along like this, and he heard twigs snapping in the distance back here. And he looked back along the path, and he saw orange and black stripes. And he realized there was a tiger out also looking for his breakfast. And it made him nervous because he thought he might be breakfast for the tiger. And he started walking fast, and the tiger heard him and came bounding along behind. And he was soon in a dead run, just crashing through the trees, trying to figure out how to get away. And the tiger, of course, catching up. And just before the tiger pounced on him, he burst into a little clearing, and he stopped up short because he came to a sheer cliff, and there was nowhere to go. And at the last second, he jumped off the cliff and caught a vine that was just out of reach, hanging from a big oak tree. And he slid down just far enough so that the huge tiger could not reach him. And the tiger did not give up. He was just there trying his best to get that vine and haul him in. So he assessed his situation. He looked down. It was a frighteningly long way to the ground. And the vine didn't even reach halfway. Not only that, there's another tiger down there at the bottom looking up at him, licking his chops, and his tail was swishing back and forth with excitement. Because he knew this was going to be lunch if he waited for it. That was not very encouraging. So he looked at the wall in front of him, the big flat wall, and there was not a toehold or a finger hold anywhere. Nothing he could get, to climb away. And the upper tiger was there, not going to let him back up. So he looked up to see how the vine was attached. It had grown round and round that oak tree limb, and back end looked very secure. He was pleased with that. But then he saw a little motion. He saw a mouse, a little mouse, as it was white. It was white as day, come walking out that branch, right out to his vine, and it stopped there, sniffed, and it went, and took a bite right out of his vine. He's like, hey, turned around, went back, and as soon as it got back, a black mouse headed out. This mouse was as dark as night, walked out to his vine, got a little bite out of it, turned around and went. And as soon as it got back, the white mouse, they just kept taking turns back and forth, taking bites out of his vine. This was very unsettling to see. It did not please the man at all, but he couldn't do anything about it. So he looked again at the flat wall in front of him, and this time he noticed something he hadn't seen before. A little tiny crevice, and some dust had blown into that crevice, and a little bit of water dribbled down in it, and a seed had fallen in there. There was a little plant growing right there in the crevice, and it was a wild strawberry plant. And on that plant was a little tiny wild strawberry. It was no bigger than the end of my finger here. And he remembered that he still had not had his breakfast. And he was very hungry. So he reached up like this, and he stretched out as far as he could. He was just able to grab that little strawberry, pluck it off, carefully brought it back so he wouldn't drop it. He put it in his mouth, and he squished it with his tongue. And it was the sweetest, tartest strawberry he had ever tasted in his entire life. That's the end of the story. Kind of leaves you hanging, doesn't it? And when I heard it, they did not. They refused to explain it to me. And it kind of distressed me. And it took me about 4 hearings and about 5 years before I figured out some of the meaning of that story. And you know, I know life is uncertain, so I'm going to give you a couple of clues, and then you can work on it. I'll tell you that the white mouse and the black mouse, they have taken over 23,000 bites out of my vine. I'm 57 years old. You can do the math. And I can tell you that we're not going to get out of this world alive. The tiger's waiting down there for every one of us. And I can also tell you that when you finally realize that, those little wild strawberries become really special. Thank you so much for listening to me, for inviting me here, for being interested in storytelling. I am so pleased. I'm so pleased for all this. May you, like Uncle Denny, live virtue, love beauty, and cultivate a sense of humor. How shall we close the meeting? Is there someone who has something they want to say or ask? Let's do that. Anyone? Thank you again for being gracious hosts and very gracious listeners. I hope you all become better storytellers. Yes. Please do, and then you can close however you like. How's that?
Well, closing the way you did, I hate riddles. And I'm not sure if this is what that is or not. We have had Leroy at our house. And sometimes when I'm around people, it gets silent and I don't know what to say and they don't know what to say. But that isn't the case with Leroy. So I've known of Leroy for many years, and was grateful to get you to know in the way that we did. Thank you for coming and blessing us. I have 2 stories, and Leroy's interested in these. In fact, he was very delighted to hear the one. And they have really nothing to do with what we were hearing tonight, but the first story has to do with his sister, Rose. I was on the school board when Rose was interviewed, and I think he can't wait to tell his sister about this. She showed up for the interview with the school board to teach at United Christian School. And back in the day, there was those shoes that the young ladies were wearing that were about this tall. I don't know, can any of you remember those kinds of shoes? The older ones, Melanie's age and Kendra's age know what kind of shoes those were. But Dave Hostetler was the principal, and I was the school board chairman, and we saw those shoes, and we had never seen any before. So we had the interview, and him and I commented about, you know, the way she looked. And Dave went home, and he told Naomi, you know, I'm not quite sure what to think of this woman. She comes maybe from a backward place, like Missouri somewhere, that they're kind of in, they don't know better on the way they dress. Naomi looked at Dave and said, Dave, she knows what she's doing. She's cutting edge. And so that was funny. And then the other thing was, I don't know when this happened, but his sister Miriam also had interviewed and was had, I believe, signed a contract to teach. And we were talking about this, and Leroy said she was very academic, more so than him or Rose. Would have been an excellent, and was an excellent teacher in her day. But in the time, between the time that she signed the contract, she was dating, and this guy got a little ahead of normal, I guess, and he asked her to marry him, and she was in a dilemma. She had promised to teach. And so I don't know how it all came about, but we had a second interview with her where she met with the board, and she said, you know, in explaining what happened, she was wanting us to, of course, release her from the contract. She started crying. It was all these men sitting around, and it was just a little too much for her. And she had nothing to wipe her, and we didn't have any Kleenexes. So Eugene Hirschberger, bless his heart, he said, "My hanky is clean." He gave her his hanky, and she wiped her tears, and the board graciously released her. So those are some stories I know of your sisters. So it's been a blessing to have you here. Thank you for coming, and hopefully we've been encouraged to draw people into the kingdom. Encourage each other with our stories. Be effective even as preachers in the way we preach in giving stories. People, I notice that when I preach, if I have a story, everybody kind of gets quiet and starts listening. So it is a good way, and it's the way Jesus taught us as well. Anyone else have a final story that you'd like to say before we dismiss this evening? Let's stand for dismissal prayer. Thank you, Lord, for the care that you have for the church. We thank you for